have 60 seconds to comply.
I think you'd better do what he says, Mr. Kenny.
You have 60 seconds to comply. This is Minute 44, part man,
part machine,
or pod.
This minute begins with Dr. Tyler turning down her co-worker's offer of chicken nuggies and ends with RoboCop waking from a nightmare.
You never, ever turn down a chicken nugget. No, you just don't.
No, the nuggies are always good.
The nuggies are always good. I have a lot of notes. I should say I've got really three notes, but one of those notes is really long.
Okay.
So, I learned a little bit into depth on the electroencephalography.
Oh, yes.
Commonly known as the EEG machine.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah. I don't know. As soon as I saw this, I was just like, oh, God. I love the tech. I love this 80s tech. And I was just like, is this a real thing? Is this actually a real thing? And yes, it is.
So that's how they used to do EEGs.
I think the newer machines are still roughly the same things. It still monitors the same thing. So an EEG monitors electrical activity on the scalp and is shown to represent the macroscopic activity of the surface layer of the brain. Basically measures electronic fluctuations from the ionic current within the neurons of the brain or the brain's spontaneous electrical activity over a period of time. Potential fluctuations are time-locked to an event, so like stimulus onset, or they call button press, what we would commonly refer to as brain waves. You know, so like when you watch Star Trek and they have like the little squiggly lines in the background, brain waves.
Well, shit. It's exactly what I was hoping to spare you from.
Yeah.
Which apparently also correspond with other, you know, weird things in Star Trek. But because I'm just thinking that one really scene where apparently Wesley Crusher knows what a brain wave looks like and Dr. Crusher doesn't.
Yeah.
God, fuck, that scene was bad. I saw this thing and I'm like going, I wonder if we're both going to talk about this.
Yeah, because, I mean, normally I would go and do the deep dive, so it just worked out that I didn't even think to discuss the EEG, which is interesting because I am going to get one soon, I'll be able to tell you guys exactly how it all works. I know they put this weird cap of buttons on your head, basically.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't think they have the reams of paper still. I think it's all digital now, but I will let you know.
Yeah, that said, I think the technology's only moved in that sense of, you know, it's essentially a plotter, you know, connect up to things that measure fluctuations. And I can't tell you exactly how it works or anything like that. I'm guessing it's a resistance electrical current thing, but it's how you kind of checked for brain waves or fluctuations in the brain activity before things like, you know, image resonancing and all the other things that we now kind of have.
So, well, MRI does not detect everything in the brain. It's really strange. So I've been sent for an MRI. My brain's totally fine, but they strongly suspect now that I have encephalitis. Encephalitis only shows up in either an EEG or a spinal tap, which I will politely decline because no thank you. But
the pain of those goes to 11.
Mm-hmm.
Gotta get that in. Yes.
Oh, of course. And there's a book called Brain on Fire, which I was just reading this morning. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's this true story of a woman who, for a whole month, just lost her goddamn mind. And they didn't know what it was, and she, you know, she had the blood test, the MRIs, all this sort of stuff, and they went, no, you're fine, you're perfectly fine, maybe it's just you're overworked, maybe it's bipolar disorder, all these sorts of things.
Wow.
And then it turned out that it was a very obscure form of encephalitis which only shows up with an EEG. And so in my case, I mean, I've been dealing with this, they think, since I was about 11. So it's just like, oh, this explains a lot about my behavior. But because it was so mild and it went on for so long that it's just, oh, well, that's just Courtney. And now I'm better. I'm like, who the hell am I? Because all those behaviors aren't me. So, look out for my memoir soon.
Well, this is why I always say biology is freaking weird. That's the thing. It's like there's no such thing as a perfect human. There's no such thing as a perfect brain. It's basically, yeah, a sponge full of spicy electricity water with anxiety. So
spicy electricity water. Yeah, and the woman who wrote this book, she was basically saying, it just made us so aware that there's no such thing as the real her, you know. She would sometimes say, oh, it's the real me coming to the surface through the illness, but it's just like, well, where do you draw that line? It's almost, yes, there are moments of clarity, but it's more like, this is who you are in this particular moment under these variables, and this is who you are under these other variables, and it's just it's a river. It's just constantly floating down a stream, unable to control it.
Yeah, like, just let's say, for example, how would you define you when, just off the top of my head, a mega corporation decides to take your brain, blank your memories, and throw you inside a robot?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're so divorced from your physical body, all those, the normal impulses, the input, the instinct, all those things that start with the letter I for some reason. Yeah. They're overruled.
I'm skipping a bit ahead to the commentary here, but so the EEG wasn't actually requested by Paul or anyone on the production side of things. It was actually sourced by the prop guys. It is an actual functioning EEG. I'm not sure if they just put up a disturbed intern onto it to get all those crazy effects, but it essentially allowed for Verhoeven to shoot around the scene, so it's not just one of those things where you got these. Okay, so this is a great example of the Kuleshov effect as well, the intercutting of different imagery to evoke emotion or to tie together emotion. So why is Robocop freaking out? We see the image of him being shot and killed, whereas the audience go, oh, he's remembering. But we don't know that Robocop still doesn't know what's going on. He's just seeing these flashes, which is setting him off. But we also, as an audience, kind of have this, trying to think of what the term is again. We have this knowledge that these machines, because we've seen probably a lot of movies where, on TV shows, where they put something on someone's head.
Sort of meta knowledge.
Yeah, so we have this pop culture knowledge of what these machines are doing. We don't know what they do. We just know, oh, the bitty thing moves, so therefore something's happening. We can assume that when Robocop's sitting down doing nothing, everything's doing nothing. And then as soon as he's freaking out, that's when the spikes are going. So it's one of those great, perfect coincidences. They didn't plan to have this machine. They got a real machine, and it ties in well with what's going on. It's a very great visual communication.
I wonder how they made it do that then, to make it...
I have no idea.
...move in a certain...
I would imagine it'd be easy just to put a current through an electrode to make it spike.
Ah, true, yeah. So the Robocop, when he's having a nightmare, the thrashing around is a little silly. It's just it's like this sort of robotic, you can't see what I'm doing, but it's like this kind of Shatnerian movements.
I can't hate it, though. I like it.
It somehow works. This is a really cool scene. I love everything about it, and I especially love the grainy imagery of his memories on the TV. Yes. There's something so haunting about that. This is such a... I don't know if it's a trope, but just it's a common thing in movies for convenience that the footage they use for memories or security footage is the actual footage we saw from the film, perfectly edited and lit and angles and
there is a term for that and I can't think what it is.
I'd love to know. But it somehow works here because it was shot in a very first person kind of way, and I'm wondering how they would have done this effect for this video. It's heavy static and then it recedes and then you see what's his name?
Broderick again.
Yeah, you keep doing that. But to do that effect now with computer effects, very easy, but back in the day, are you actually playing around with VHS static?
Yeah, that was all done in camera, obviously. So that shot of Boddicker is actually an unused shot that Paul took, I think, I'm not sure if it was during the shooting scene or during, like a test or something like that, because it actually is a POV shot of Boudica, so it is actually very much what Murphy would have seen, except maybe like the backlit and stuff like that, because you know I'm a photographer, I can just go, no, that doesn't match the lighting source. God damn it, this is going to bug me if I just try to, because like say music in movies is usually external, so like a score is not
diegetic.
Thank you. That was bugging the crap out of me. So non-diegetic is where something is external to the scene. So yeah, all that footage of the Boudica gang shooting Murphy and as it pans across, that's all non-diegetic. But it's conveying the emotion that Murphy's feeling. We're not getting a POV of Murphy in that scene at all. We're all seeing it externally. But the monitor with Boudica, that's diegetic, because that's what the recording equipment is measuring off Murphy's brain.
Yeah.
Or at least it's overriding a signal. Thank you, diegetic. God, that was going to bug the ever-loving crap out of me.
I am the keeper of the words.
But yeah, it's a handy tool to have. Is, you know, and yeah, sometimes they blur the line between diegetic and non-diegetic. I think one of my favorite ones is, I think it's in Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs, where you know it starts with the music. Tarantino loves to do this kind of stuff. So it starts off with the music in the ending credits scene, then it cuts to a car and it's playing on the radio. That's an example of a non-diegetic music source turning into a diegetic music source.
Yeah. Baby Driver is all that.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to watch Baby Driver now. Hang on.
I don't think I actually got around to seeing that.
Oh, damn. I mean, well, you know me and cars, so I'm going to say it's amazing.
Yeah. No, I not being a car person, yeah. I'll have to get around to watching that, because I do like watching old Edgar Wright stuff, but...
No, so only on Prime Video and Binge, all right? Yeah, a total tangent, but maybe the audience will be interested that, Simon did me a big favor and came with me to get my first car, and it was, I mean, it's, okay, this is a beautiful old Saab, it's not some bombed out piece of shit, so it's mostly fine, but the gearbox is utterly fucked.
So was it the gearbox or was it the clutch?
So the clutch is fine according to the mechanic. That all feels fine. It is literally just the shifter. There's something that's either broken or missing in there, which is better, I guess, because if the clutch is fucked, that's the entire transmission. You've got to pull that out of there. Yes, we have to get the car towed, and she's just sat in the driveway ever since. My life is the movie Christine right now, where it's just, I got my first car, I'm obsessed with it, and people tell me, no, don't buy this car. I bought the car for a crazy cheap amount, and it may be cursed, who can say? And, yeah.
I still reckon you should paint two gold horns on there, and it's the Cars Universe Loki.
Yes. That also works.
Well, you can have Alligator Loki. You can always...
Alligator Loki, Loki, there you go.
I do have a note here that just says retrofuturism is cool. Because it's something I've been thinking about. But I might leave that till next minute, because I don't have much to say for the next minute.
That's all my notes. So did we want to jump into Gaslighting Robocop already?
Oh, this is going to be a short episode.
Yeah. But,
there is a bit in different in the book.
Oh yes.
I want to point out. So the script is almost exactly the same. They have the line, "Thought I'd go to Acapulco, but the rebels blew up the airport again," which is slightly in this minute. But the so I don't know if we've ever talked about the anti. I'm going to use a bad word, but it's kind of what a lot of the academics use: the anti-Orientalism of cyberpunk. Not necessarily anti-Asian, but a lot of like the anti-Japan sentimentality.
Really? Because I thought it was more it appropriates rather than being anti.
No, but that's the thing. It appropriates, but then it also denigrates, because it's always like, oh yeah, we, you know, getting all this great electronics in, but then it's always a dig at Japan because the cheap shit electronics come at Japan.
Right.
So there's like twice in this thing, it's like, ugh, Japanese equipment, when Robocop's glitching, or we know he's starting to awaken.
Right, because I'm thinking Blade Runner, where I think it does sort of glorify Japanese culture, but in this removed kind of way.
Yeah, but we're getting deep into the 80s here, where like a lot of demonization of Japan culture is starting to be a little bit...
Back to the Future too.
Yeah, so it's one of those things where Japan were making a lot of cheap electronics, but the Americans were benefiting from that. But then there was the whole thing of like the industry moving away from America to Japan, and that became a lot of the demonization of that. It is complicated.
Mm.
But yeah, it's not, which is funny that a lot of this movie doesn't really have that much of an issue of that. But no, the book still has it. So it must have been, could have been in a previous script and they might have removed it. No idea. It's funny for this kind of era, there's no real kind of, I don't know, jingoism, I guess. You know, there's no, even the cops, you know, they're a multiracial, multigender police force, you know?
Yeah, I feel like a lot of that jingoism came in post 9/11. That's, I definitely remember a lot of that around the time of the early 2000s, where it was just everywhere, just this American pride to this absurd degree. I mean, America's always had an absurd degree of pride in its nation. You know, as an Australian, it's just like, calm down, man. Calm down.
Oh, I think I just realized something. So basically, a lot of that dingoism in the 80s was a lot of, like, say, pro-Reagan bullshit. Like, you know, this is why you get a movie like, say, First Blood, which is all about the horrors of Vietnam War. And there's a lot of bullshit regarding prisoners of war being kept around in that. That didn't happen. There's no evidence for that. But then you get to First Blood Part 2, and it's all about, you know, the one American soldier beating up the entire Vietnam army. And then you get to Rambo 3, and it's one American soldier beating up the Australian army. So... And you get a move like this, which is very anti-capitalist, very anti-corporate, and, you know, pretty much anti-Reagan. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise that a lot of our heroes in this aren't just these, you know, examples of male testosterone BS.
Which is nice.
Anyway, that's third for four.
Yeah.
A little bit of political commentary on, which is going to piss off some people, I know that.
Man, now I'm thinking, maybe we should do a little review of Starship Troopers.
Oh, yeah, that could be either really painful or... I do have the original book around somewhere, but it's probably in a box in an attic.
Yes. Anyway, we'll focus on that after we finish RoboCop.
Yeah, that could be a special episode if, you know, we ever get Patreon and a lot of people give us money. But I guess we should get on to the next part. Gaslighting RoboCop.
Here we go, gaslighting RoboCop.
Alex, how do you feel?
I feel fine, Dr. Norton.
This minute begins with RoboFlag eyes to camera and ends with Sellers saying, I've got to give the American people something we can root for, something aspirational. Did it all in one breath.
Yeah. My only comment is, once again, the better characters aren't Murphy.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this scene intrigues me because I think, you know, these are two very great actors and there's something interesting going on there, but it doesn't quite hit at the spot because, you know, I think in the last minute we were talking about how it could have been interesting if we had this kind of interplay between Rorschach and Norton. And I'll never not stumble over that. You know, Morton, Norton.
No, me neither.
Yeah, Norton. And Norton Antivirus, the Doctor.
That's the ding.
Ding, yeah. Norton Antivirus, MD.
Yes.
Ding, 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 baby. So, yeah, I think the problem with this particular scene is, I mean, this is fine, but I think it misses something, and that's you need Norton to be kind of team human. He needs to be defending, he needs to be defending that perspective, and so far we don't have anyone doing that, and even Norton, who should be on the side of humanity, is sort of like, well, look, this is what happens when you put a man inside of a machine, you know, what did you expect? And he's not This is a guy who works in cybernetics. He is the one who is all about this technology, and he should believe in it. You know, like how Rorschach is all about, these are my machines, and I trust them, and I know what they can do, and they're amazing.
Mm.
Norton should be the exact counterpoint, going, I know what cyborgs can accomplish. I know how amazing it is to merge man with machine, and we don't get that perspective.
Mm. No, I think it's one of those things where Keaton knows what he's doing as this character. He's definitely internalized the goals, and so he's just like, you know, yep, I'm the corporate asshole. You know, it's just that thing where you're failing to deliver me kind of this impossible thing that I demanded, you know, 5 seconds ago. And I love that vibe off of Keaton in this scene. But yeah, it's almost that weird thing where Gary Oldman just doesn't seem to know what he's doing, or maybe his direction was just like, you know. It's almost that weird, because it doesn't feel like the same character that we've just seen.
Mm.
It's almost that thing where he should have either made it a bit more extreme in the performance, either like, you know, not confident because he's dealing with this ultra-rich, mega-powerful dude, or he should be a bit more, maybe even a bit more excited, like, yeah, this thing has happened. Sure, it's not perfect, but think about it, the potential.
Yeah, I think... I don't know, it just... Yeah... From
the B word is coming back.
It's more a case of we don't have that counterpoint. It's everyone in this. Well, the last scene and this scene is sort of like, this is not going to work. This is not going to work. This is a failure. Mm. And yeah, I think it would have been. So, I don't know what it is, but somehow I feel like that would make me more invested if you have at least one person saying, no, this can be done. And this technology is good, and yeah, all of that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just that thing where... This is why I was bringing up the whole thing of, like, you know, if you're testing RoboCop, why aren't you showing us these, like, progressions? And we don't... I just don't never remember any progression in this movie. It just seems to be this thing of, they build him, they do a thing... They throw him into a thing, and then eventually he has a freak-out, blubbering mess, and they have to wipe his brain.
Well, it's story-moving character rather than character-moving story, and letting these characters bring up their own inherent conflicts with each other, and letting that push the story along.
Yeah.
And it's a real shame, because now that we've spent a considerable amount of time on this, I'm realizing, wow, you know what, I think... Especially Norton. I mean, I always like Norton, I always like Gary Oldman, but I'm kind of seeing that, oh, yeah, wow, there's actually science fiction. Well, not so much film, but science fiction in general should be about deeper ideas, and I feel like Norton's the perfect vessel for those kind of counterpoints, because in a lot of especially action science fiction movies, it's all just human is inferior, machine is superior, but until, you know, the plucky human is able to overcome the Terminator or whatever it is, you know, it kind of has that, what's the word, like... futility is a feeling of futility, like, oh, machines will ultimately always be superior to us, but you know, there's going to be that one plucky group or one hero is just gonna resist. But yeah,
it's funny because, like, people think of sci-fi and they think of it like being instinctively kind of pro-science, because like it tends to show science and stuff like that.
Not sci-fi movies.
Well, no, that's the funny thing is, like, historically, science fiction has always been a cautionary tale about science in a weird way.
Oh, Frankenstein, yeah.
It's almost going back to that anti-intellectualism. Even Frankenstein, the very first, well, at least acknowledged as the very first science fiction story, is very much about man's hubris trying to get the power of God. And it's at the end of the day, man's abomination has to be destroyed because he overstepped his boundaries. That's literally the theme of Frankenstein.
You know, have you noticed that it's mostly only men who have this God complex? You know, your Frankensteins, well, your Elon Musks, your Bill Gates of the world.
Mary Shelley kind of wrote Frankenstein, but yes, it's not that hard of just a theme to see there.
Well, interesting you mentioned Mary Shelley, because yeah, so for her relationship with life and death and creation, all that, as a woman was through childbirth, and for a man they don't have that. So I feel like that's, you know, maybe getting a little bit Freudian, but I think women, when they get to a certain period of their life, they manifest that anxiety about mortality through the desire to have children.
Yeah.
Whereas men are all about, I must build a monument to myself. I need to be remembered. I need to do something to prove my worth and be remembered.
I need to build the biggest dick structure in the world. So that's why we get the pyramids. That's why we get temples. That's Washington why we get Monument. Churches. And that's why we get the Washington Monument. And that's why we get skyscrapers. Yeah, skyscrapers. I was going to say starscrapers. But that's going to be the next
one. That's the sequel. The sequel to skyscrapers.
Yeah, that's when Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are building their big dicks in space.
Yes. Yeah, there is obviously a lot of reasons why women don't enter the STEM fields, or they don't become CEOs. There's a lot working against them. But I also feel that inherently women just don't view these things the same way. And I don't know, it fascinates me. I don't know what that is.
Well, it's funny because a lot of the early computing jobs, like the original programmers, mostly were women. It was essentially STEM, not necessarily like, say, the people in the laboratoire were women, but a lot of the like computer stuff, the programmers, the original analysts in like the space program and all that, were women.
Yeah.
And it essentially, when it became cool to do computer stuff, so they kind of got pushed out because, you know, oh, women can't do computer stuff, so they don't have the brains. Like, they've been doing it for decades.
Yeah, it's funny that like they started off though, because they were doing all the calculating work pre-digital era, and so they just got moved over to, this is kind of like calculating, but in the future. And
It's like calculating. You're still using a keyboard, you're still typing things, but what you're typing is memos for the man.
Jesus.
We're going to get cancelled by some fucking chuds on this one.
Yeah. And then, not to go too much on a tangent, but I think this is all interesting. That sewing's one of those fields that have gone from masculine, feminine. It's gone back and forth. So initially, men were only allowed to be tailors and make clothes. And then it was women, and then it kind of went back to men again. And now, it's definitely seen as a feminine thing.
It's almost like gender roles are socially constructed. But it's nice to know that even in the far distant future, women can't be CEOs of mega corporations.
Yeah, I cannot think of any. I think it'd be one of those like Hunger Game ripoffs. I think
probably
Kate Winslet is like the big bad bitch. And there's another one with like Tilda Swinton, but for the most part, the big bad is a man.
Hey, Tilda Swinton was awesome as the big bad in Constantine.
Yes, I mean, she's great in everything, let's be honest.
Yes, she is.
She's one of those actresses I will watch in anything.
So I think that's about it.
Yeah, that's basically it. I'll save it for the next minute. Simon, where can we find you?
Oh, where can find me? We're changing this up. Okay, you can find me on Fandom Crossing and at Helios Photos. I'm on Facebook and all that junk. I do Kung Pao into the Minute occasionally. I gotta write some of that shit up. I haven't had time.
Oh my god, I'm so far behind my podcast. My life is just, again, my life is like the movie Christine. So, you know, my new girlfriend / car is taking up my entire life. She's very jealous.
Speaking of podcasts, where can the lovely viewers find you and all your 1,000 podcast guestings?
Right now we're doing a bit of a change up. So I don't know if I'm doing the Alien prequels weekly anymore. It might be Tron. So stay tuned to that. But if you just want to find the latest news, go over to Covenant Minute on Facebook, or head on over to patreon.com/traviandesigns. And I think that's everything for now. Yes.
You're still going to get your weekly dose of RoboCop.
Exactly. You can still hear me every week talking about RoboCop.
Speaking of which, you can check us out on Spotify, Google, Apple, things, Simplecast. Did I say Simplecast? There's a lot of S's. We're on YouTube. Please click like, share, subscribe, all that other stuff. Rate, review, the other bullshit, because the algorithm hates us, but we have to appease the algorithmic overlord. And I believe yours the outro this time. So until next time.
Robocock!
Thank you.